Can you hear me, right? Okay. Right. So, I'm extremely pleased to be here at Perimeter because I've been trying to come here for a long time, actually, almost for 2 years, but because of various reasons, things got canceled. In fact, as you can see here, this was when my talk was originally supposed to be, on February 25th, but that again got postponed because of some other reason. So that's why this old date is there, which I'm only seeing right now. But anyway, finally I'm here, so let me start off. Okay, so since this is a quantum gravity seminar, but my work, at least the work that I've done, is completely classical, but I'll start off by speaking something about quantizing gravity. Okay, so I'm a relativist in the sense that I come from the general relativity background. So when I hear this term, quantizing gravity, so it basically brings to mind something like this. Okay, to me, this is gravity, and you quantize gravity as in you do something to gravity, you force do something. Okay, that is the image that comes to my mind. The complete picture in this particular case is something like this. Okay, this is from Economic Times, The Power of Knowledge. Okay, I would like to think of this as the cat representing quantum mechanics, and it's almost like you are tying it up so that, you know, it doesn't hurt the cat. But probably, I mean, so that's why I don't like that term quantizing gravity that much. As in, gravity, you quantize it. Rather, you should have something like this. You should have both the gravity part as well as the quantum part coexisting, at least in my mind. So now, as I said, I have not really worked on quantum gravity as such. It's not because I have any problem with quantum gravity as such. It's just that, I've never felt the need to work on quantum gravity. Okay, so at least in my opinion, the problems that we work on are the problems that you sort of feel something for. You should fall in love with the problem. And at least in my career, so in the beginning, I never had such a need to go and quantize gravity. So when I was doing my PhD, I worked on both gravity as well as quantum, but I've generally tried to stay away from the conflict zones. But although I've generally tried that, one problem that I chose, which is this, constructing action for GR, it did force me to go and look at the quantum aspect as well. Because if you look at action principle, you have Daniel Bowman's statement here. So action principle has many good aspects. It's elegant, it has many uses, you can derive Noether currents from it, etc., etc. But if you think of it completely classically, as far as I'm concerned, and in my experience, action principle and equations of motion, they are equivalent. Action principle is just a device with which you can derive the equations of motion, at least classically. So even posing this problem, constructing a well-posed action for GR, which is what I'm going to talk about right now, it doesn't make sense unless you also consider the quantum aspect. So even though whatever I'm going to tell you right now, it's completely classical, I mean, there is nothing quantum coming in, the whole motivation behind this, it is quantum. Unless you go into quantum mechanics, you don't have a motivation, as far as I understand, to construct a well-posed action. Okay, so let me start off. The first few slides are things that I believe most of you are generally aware of, so I'll go through it fast. So if you start off, first I'll assume that the dynamical variable for the gravitational field is the metric. Okay, so I've also worked with Palatini formulation where you take the metric and connection as separate. We also looked at connection formulation. I do like the connection formulation for some particular reasons, but at least for this talk, I'll always take the variable as the metric. When you take the variable as the metric, and if you try to construct a Lagrangian made of the metric and the first derivatives, and it has to be a scalar density, so the unique scalar density that you can come up with is this. You only have the cosmological constant term. This is an interesting theory because if you vary it, you basically get the metric equal to TAB equation. So you get GAB equal to TAB. So it's a sort of extreme Machian theory. Rather than saying that the metric is one that is Minkowski when you don't have matter, this is a theory where when the matter is not there, even the metric doesn't exist. And there will be no Schwarzschild solution in this theory. So that probably is not viable. I don't know how to make this work. So you have to go to higher derivative actions. So go up one level, you have the metric, you have the derivative of the metric, and double derivatives. And in general, second order Lagrangians have fourth order equations of motion, and this has problems. As you know, the theory might have ghosts, or classically speaking, there is Ostrogresky instability. You go to the Hamiltonian, Hamiltonian might be unbounded form below, etc., etc. So in order to avoid these problems, you want a higher derivative action, but which will give you a second order equation of motion. And this can happen only if you have a second order Lagrangian, where the second order derivatives separate out into a total derivative. So all the second order terms, it has to separate out into a total derivative. And in fact, the claim is that if you put together principle of equivalence, general covariance, and second order field equations, the unique Lagrangian that you can construct out of the metric is the Lankos-Lovelock Lagrangians. So Lankos-Lovelock Lagrangians, if you go to d equal to 4, you have the Einstein-Hilbert term plus the Gauss-Bonnet term and of course the cosmological constant term. Now, in this talk, I'm going to talk about a well-posed option in the sense I'm not going to just throw away the total derivatives. I'm going to consider the total derivatives. So in that sense, I should also be worried about the Gauss-Bonnet term because it's generally thrown away because people say it's total divergence. It doesn't affect the equations of motion. But for me, this is important. But at least for the purpose of this talk, I'll be just working with the Einstein-Hilbert action. Okay, so I'll just restrict to Einstein-Hilbert action. Yes.
Can you remind us what the Lovelock action is?
Oh, so it has an expression in the sense, so I don't have the expression over here, but at least in four dimensions, it's uniquely just the Einstein-Hilbert term plus the Gauss-Bonnet term. So if you restrict four dimensions.
Take two epsilons and contract powers of Riemann and first two with each, with epsilons in the way that it doesn't vanish.
Okay. Okay, thank you. The
starter
may know that. Your
rest later knowledge. Yeah, so. At least mine. Anyway, at least for my talk, I do not have to use the formalism of Lankos-Lovelock. I'm going to purely work with Einstein-Hilbert. So for that, I haven't really given the expression for what the Lankos-Lovelock Lagrangian is. Okay, so you have the Einstein-Hilbert term and the Gauss-Bonnet term. Okay, I'm going to restrict to Einstein-Hilbert, et cetera, et cetera. But even if you include Gauss-Bonnet, how to get a good action with Gauss-Bonnet included, people have worked on it. Even Rob Myers here, he has a paper on it. Now, restricting to Einstein-Hilbert, you consider Einstein-Hilbert and you consider its variation. So you take the variation, this is the equation of motion part, and this is the boundary part. Now the boundary part, I've written in terms of this variable where NCAB is some object which is constructed out of the Christoffel symbol alone. Now this contains both the metric and its derivatives, and hence the boundary variation contains variations of both the metric and its derivatives, okay? So people generally consider this as a problem in the sense that on the boundary, if you have to set this variation to zero, you have to set variations of both the metric and its derivative to zero. So this is why people have always tried to add certain boundary terms in gravity to take away this extra variation of the first derivative of the metric. So brief history. So even Einstein initially was a little worried about the second derivative structure of the Einstein-Hilbert action. So in the 1916 paper where he discusses the variational principle for GR using square root of minus GR, and he cites Hilbert as well as Lorentz. So in this paper, he says that in order to obtain a variational principle which is more convenient to us, he throws away a total divergence term and obtains this Lagrangian, which is known as gamma-gamma Lagrangian or Einstein Lagrangian. Okay, so this is a first derivative Lagrangian. Now effectively, in our language, at least the language that I'm going to use right now, this can be done by adding a boundary term to the action, which is of this form, okay? So you can do that. If you want, you can call this as the Einstein boundary term. Okay, so that is what Einstein did. Now, then, okay, the problem with this prescription is that you get a gamma-gamma Lagrangian. It's not a covariant Lagrangian. Okay, it's not a scalar. If you go to a local initial frame, this is zero. Generally, in GR, we like to work with covariant objects. So with the metric alone, it's not possible to go and create something that is covariant and in first derivatives. But if you go to a formalism like ADM, where you also have an NA thrown in, you also have an N which is coming in. You can then split the action into these terms. So you have this ADM action plus this total divergence. York in 1972, he took this decomposition and showed that this particular term, when integrated, it will give you an integral of minus 2 root h k on the boundary. Okay, he does this. Although in that paper, he doesn't say that, okay, you have to actually kill this term, put something to kill this term. He doesn't mention this. But there is another paper. So this is a paper by Gaudi. Okay, so this is cited by York in this paper. In that paper, he actually mentions, so you have this 2 root h k term, and then he says that this has to be dropped in order to have variations in which only the initial and final hypersurface 3 geometries, that is the metric, 3 metric on the final and initial hypersurface have to be fixed. You have to drop this, okay? So at least in the papers that I've seen, this is the earliest reference where somebody talks about dropping this term. Then of course there's the famous paper next by Gibbons and Hawking, in which they said, okay, they wanted to do some path integral stuff. So for that, they only had to fix the metric on the boundaries, and they said, so they'll add this particular term to the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian. They say, in order to obtain an action which depends only on the first derivative of the metric, as is required by the path integral approach. Of course, if you add this, it's not that, it's the ADM action. So you basically get the ADM action. It depends not only on the first derivatives of the matrix, but even the first spatial derivatives are there, second spatial derivatives are there. So this should actually be first time derivatives of the metric. So the time derivatives of the metric are eliminated by adding this, okay? So that was the Gibbons-Hawking paper. And so I'll be calling this particular term as GHY term for Gibbons-Hawking and York. And then Rob Myers here in 1987, he showed that this action with GHY included, if you take a two-dimensional manifold, this is precisely the Euler character for a two-dimensional manifold. Okay, now coming to the need for boundary terms, so why do you need a boundary term in the first place? So people generally argue like this. You have two ways of dealing with dynamics. If you have dynamics, either you go from an equation of motion point of view, you have an equation, generally a second order equation, you specify q and q dot at the boundary, at the initial surface, and then you solve it, okay? The second way is as a solution of a variational problem. You're given an action with boundary conditions. You get a boundary term for this action as follows, and then you have to kill the boundary term. So this is done by fixing q at the boundaries. Okay, there are these two ways. Generally, these are equivalent. You fix q and q dot u at the initial point, and q at initial and final points, you get unique solutions. Okay, but total derivatives change the variational problem. If you add a total derivative, it's not going to affect the equations of motion. So at least the equations motion problem doesn't change, but it can change the variational problem. As for example, in my case, suppose I'm going to add a total derivative of this term, then the boundary term becomes of this form, so that right now you have to fix both q and q dot at both boundaries. Okay, so this, people say, this problem is not well posed because you have four boundary conditions. So you have q, q dot at the initial surface, q, q dot at the final surface. These are four conditions for a second order equation of motion. A general solution of a second order equation of motion, it has two constants. So once you fix q, q dot at the initial condition, this is already fixed. You don't have freedom to fix arbitrary q, q dot at the boundary. Okay. So unless chosen with special care, unless you choose q, q dot at the final boundary to be precisely the same that comes from evolution of the q, q dot at the initial case, you will not, I mean, these things cannot be matched. So that is why in such cases, people say that the variational problem is not well posed. Okay, so that is all right. I mean, this is something that we can understand. It's easy to understand. Although, to me, this was not motivation enough because okay, you have two formalisms. You have a variational formalism. You have an equation of motion formalism. And it is not clear to me why there should be this match between it, in the sense that it's true that if I take arbitrary qq dot at the initial point and arbitrary qq dot at the final point, then you might not have a classical path between them. But why can't I choose qq dot at the initial point, set the path in such a way, and then I'll choose qq dot at the final point such that it matches this condition. I have the choice in the sense that unless I want to be completely free in my choice of my initial conditions and final conditions, there is no need for me to be worried about this. So the question is, why should there be a freedom to choose arbitrary QQ dot at the initial point as well as arbitrary QQ dot at the final point? Okay, unless we don't need this freedom, you don't have to even worry about this issue. So this is not really discussed in very many places. A couple of references that I know are, one is, so Padmanabhan, so Paddy, my supervisor, he has this book, Gravitation. So he talks about this problem. He says that he gives three conditions, three arguments. So he says that the first problem is that for arbitrary values of Q and Q dot at both t equal to T1 and T equal to T2, we may not have a classical solution satisfying the boundary condition. So this is exactly what I've stated now. Basically, that the variational problem is not well posed, okay? But this is a classical statement. And as far as I'm concerned, classically, I don't even care about the variational principle, okay? So this is not enough motivation for me. The second one is that we would like the action principle to obey a composition law that action going from 1 to 2 and 2 to 3 is the sum of action going from 1 to 2 plus 2 to 3, okay? So this, generally, you require this in path integral formalism, because when you have path integral formalism, you do consider paths which are not only continuous, but they can also have at points discontinuities in the derivative. Okay, so path can be continuous at boundaries, but they may not be smooth. You can have places where the paths are actually changing their velocities. So if you have to consider such paths, and then you want to have sum of amplitudes, then you need such a prescription, and for that you cannot have an action principle where you have to fix the variable as well as the velocity at the boundary. I'll discuss this in more detail. And finally, the action principle has its roots in quantum theory, and freezing Q and Q dot simultaneously will require specifying the values of both coordinate and momentum at a given time. Okay, this also I can sort of accept, because once you have a second order equation of motion, I know that my phase space has Q and Q dot will go with the momentum. And if I'm specifying my initial state, maybe it's not right for me to specify both Q and Q dot together. Okay, this depends on the second order equation of motion. If you go to higher order, higher order action, higher order equations, then this might not be true. Another paper is this paper by Dyer and Kurt Hinderbickler in 2008. Okay. So they say the adequate freedom in boundary conditions is essential for, one, Hamilton-Jacobi formulation. Okay, so this I don't understand that well. So Kurt was actually my roommate here. So I was talking to him about it, but I haven't understood this that well. So I won't talk about it now. But the second point that they make is, again, path integral formulation of quantum mechanics. So this is what I will discuss in more detail right now. So this was also Hawking's original argument for a boundary term. So he had this argument coming from path integrals. So there is this argument. So there was the original paper by Gibbons and Hawking. In that, there was just one line saying that they would like it to be continuous. I mean, they wouldn't like to fix the derivatives of the metric at the boundary. But in an Einstein Centenary Survey, Hawking had an article where he expanded on this argument. So this is what he did. He said, okay, consider this case. So this is a space-like surface, and this is another space-like surface. Suppose you have the metric, the three metric on this space-like surface, with the three metric on this space-like surface, and this is a time-like tube bounding it. Okay, he wanted to consider the amplitude of evolution from here to here. Okay, this amplitude, and okay, this G is the metric inside, the bulk metric. Now, he said, suppose we introduce another surface in between. So there is S1, S2, and you introduce another surface in between. This is S3. And then you consider cases where you evolve from H1 to H2, and then evolve from H2 to S3. So normally, we would like the evolution to be given by such an amplitude. The amplitude to go from H1 to H3 should be the amplitude to go from H1 to H2, and then H2 to H3, summed over all states at H2. This is something we would like. In order to have such a rule, you require additivity in the action. You need to have the action to satisfy the rule that action of this part plus action of this part should give you the action of the whole part. Now, problem is, as I said, in Parthenogle, many times you consider paths which are not smooth at this boundary. You know, the normal derivatives can change. So if you have normal derivatives of the metric changing here, okay, if they do not match at S2, then you can show that the Ricci tensor has a delta function of strength this at the boundary. Okay, so there is a Ricci tensor of strength this at the boundary. Physically, you can think of it as there being a matter shell sitting over here. Okay, and when there is such a discontinuity, so in order to take care of that, so now you don't have additivity of action anymore because you have a delta function sitting over here. So if you integrate from here to here, and if you integrate from here to here, and you add it up, you don't take care of this delta function. Okay, so in order to take care of this delta function, he said, we have to add this integral of 2 root hk over the boundary to the action. Okay, then the action will become additive. Okay, so this is Hawking's argument. Now, one question that one may ask is that this argument holds only if you consider discontinuous paths. Not discontinuous paths, paths which are discontinuous in the velocity. Okay, so the question is, in path integral, should we actually consider paths which are discontinuous in velocity? To ask another question, why is it that we should even consider paths which are continuous? Okay, why can't we path arbitrary paths? You know, path go from here, then path goes from here. So if you go to Feynman and Hips, they have this diagram that they have, which what they would like to claim is that the typical paths of a quantum mechanical particle are highly irregular. So what they mean is the following. They take the transition amplitude of xk plus 1 minus xk. They consider a case where, you know, particle motion is discretized. You go from xk to sk plus 1. You take this transition amplitude, and they show that this is of this value. So when you take epsilon going to 0 limit, then this diverges. Their conclusion is that the typical paths do not have a definite slope. Okay, so the paths which contribute to the path integral do not have a definite slope. So if you're calculating path integrals, you should include these paths which have, you know, discontinuous slopes. From the same, you can also get this formula, which when you put epsilon to 0, xk plus 1 goes to xk. So basically, as epsilon tends to give 0, the transition element of displacement goes to 0. So the typical paths are continuous. So typical paths do not have a definite slope, but they have to be continuous. Okay. So these conclusions, if you go through the derivation, they follow from the equations of motion. So they follow from the second order equation of motion. Adding a total derivative does not change it. So even for the Einstein-Hilbert action, which has a second order equation of motion, these conclusions should be valid. You should take these paths, which are continuous but discontinuous in first derivatives. But again, if you go to higher derivative actions, this may not be true. There is a claim in the literature that if you go to, say, higher derivative actions, the typical path may actually be continuous in velocity. Okay, now, okay, so now since we have talked about the need for the boundary term, let's actually come to the boundary term itself that is used in general relativity. So the most commonly used one is the Gibbons-Hawking-Yorke boundary term. This is the form. So you have the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term. It is an integral of root h del a n a, where n is the normalized normal and h is the determinant of the surface metric on the boundary. So this is the GHY term, and this is now textbook material, like Wald has it, Paddy's textbook has it, Relativist Toolkit has it, etc., etc. So this is standard accepted fact. Now this GHY term, it requires both the normalized normal and a non-zero determinant of the surface metric for its definition. You need an h here, which is non-zero, and this is the normalized metric. Normalized normal, sorry. So you need both the normalized normal and a non-zero determinant of the surface metric for its definition. Now the problem is both these quantities exist only for a space-like or time-like surface. Okay, if you go to a null surface, you don't have a normalized normal. It is not defined. And also, the determinant of the surface metric goes to zero. So this basically diverges, this goes to zero. It's not even clear whether there's a limit for that. Okay, now null surfaces, so I'll just skim through this rapidly. What is a null surface? You take some phi equal to constant surfaces in space-time, you take its normal. Generally, you normalize it using this norm, but for a null surface, what happens is this norm goes to zero, so you can't use the conventional normalization. And okay, so you can't use the conventional normalization. Now, another property of the null surface is that you have this formula LA, LA equal to 0. What this basically means that even the vector LA, which is what we call normal, is actually on the boundary. So the vector LA, the normal one form, if you make it into a vector, it actually lies on the boundary. LA lies on the phi equal to constant null surface. So if you have to project tensors onto the null surface, generally people do it using normalized normal in space-like and time-like cases. For a null surface, this can be done by introducing an auxiliary null vector, k. So you introduce another vector k such that k LA equal to minus 1. And this is what people use to project things on a null surface. And the metric, the induced metric on the null surface is generally given as this. So you have GAB plus LAKB plus KLB. This is essentially the metric of a two surface, which is orthogonal to LA on the surface. So LA are these null geodesics on the surface. And this two surface is transverse to it, OK? Transverse to both LA and K. Now, so there is this technical point that I want to make, that is, there are two ways of specifying a null surface. One way is what I've just said, that you have a normal, and this normal goes to 0. If you look at it from the metric point of view, in a coordinate system with phi as one of the coordinates, this corresponds to this component of the metric going to 0. OK, that is one way to state it. Another way to state it is to say that h, the determinant of the tree metric on the surface, so this goes to 0. OK, it becomes degenerate. That is a second way to state it. Generally, both are equivalent, because you have root minus g equal to n root h going to 0, n going to infinity, and generally root minus g remains finite, generally.
There are lots of things where h can degenerate where the surface isn't null, too, right? Any kind of coordinate singularity, et cetera, this happens all the time.
So what I'm saying is, if you take this as the definition of a null surface, So what I'm saying is, so you were saying there are cases where the surface metric might go to 0, but it's not a null surface.
Yes.
That is what you're saying, right?
Sure.
That is true. That is true. But it can go both ways.
That was the only point.
Yeah, it's possible.
That in the sense that degeneracy doesn't necessarily indicate the surface is null.
Well, the point is, the point is, I agree to the point that these two are not always connected, okay? There are cases, okay, just a second, I'll come back to that. So what I was saying is that in general, you have root minus g equal to n root h, and most of the metrics that we deal with, you have root minus g to be finite at a point, but what happens is either g phi phi goes to 0, and in which case you have n, which goes to infinity, and root h goes to 0, both have to take place simultaneously. It is connected by this relation, but it doesn't always hold. So I wanted to go to the other side, saying that there are cases, for example, this is a metric which is considered by Visser and Co. in some paper. So for example, in this metric, what happens is you have this relation, and then you have a t equal to constant surface where n goes to infinity, OK? That is a null surface if you go back according to this. Okay, it's a null surface. The normal goes to null. But the metric on the surface is not 0 in this case. I think you are talking about the other case, where you are cases where h goes to 0, but the normal doesn't satisfy.
I think as long as you do add the second criterion and that also the g is finite and non-zero, then I think you're on the same ground.
Yes.
But just h going to 0, no, there are lots of cases where.
Yes, I agree. So these are two independent things. But when you have root minus g finite, then they are connected. So I can go either way. And at least in my talk, what I'll do is I'll only restrict to matrix where root minus g doesn't go to 0. Okay, and of course, this is invariant under choice of coordinates, because once I choose a coordinate, then any one-to-one mapping where Jacobian doesn't vanish, you'll have this particular property. Okay, so I'm going to restrict to such cases. So for me, in this talk, both of these are equivalent, either h equal to 0 or this thing vanishing. Okay, now, okay, importance of null surfaces. So this is a statement by Roger Penrose. So he says that for the two fields most important to relativity, electromagnetism and gravitation, they propagate in null direction along null surfaces. And also the fact that all direct large-scale observations of the universe that have been made lie on what is essentially a null cone. Okay, so there is this thing, okay, we do all numerical relativity, et cetera, on space-like surfaces, give data on space-like surfaces, but at least the data that we observe is actually using, say, light. That lies on a null cone. Okay, so in fact, people are even trying to follow this train of thought. There was Professor Nigel Bishop who was visiting at IUCA just before I came. So their program is basically to take observations which lie on a null cone and using that, try to see whether you can reconstruct data on the space-like surface. Okay, so people are trying to do this. I guess even Lewis here was involved in similar work. And so there is also this statement. You argue that finite region observables in quantum gravity are best approached in terms of boundary data on null surfaces. So this is by Yasha here. Okay, so we can talk to him about why this statement is true. But once you have, so even if you don't think that null surfaces are more important or less important than non-null surfaces, it's a fact that they exist in relativity. Okay, you have to take care of them, as in there are null surfaces. So when you're working with relativity, you would also be interested in knowing what is the boundary term for a null surface. Okay, and what are the previous attempts in this direction? There is a PhD thesis by Barth in 1983. But this I did not find very useful because it was in the framework of a very particular metric. So he takes a very particular form of the null metric. So I didn't find that useful. There's a paper by Barabas and Israel. This is in 2005, and they give this form of a boundary term. This for a z equal to constant boundary. So z equal to constant is their boundary, and they say that this can be used as a boundary term. Even Yasha's paper in 2012, it has an expression for the case where you have a null boundary. The expression is basically this. He defines something known as a area current, and again, r equal to constant is his surface, and this, he says, is his boundary term, okay? Now, I'm going to talk about my boundary terms. At least, I don't understand both their formalisms very well, but at least sitting down and trying to calculate, I could see that in the case where I have my null surface, null boundary, embedded in a null foliation, like I have phi equal to constant is my boundary, I take all phi equal to constant surfaces as null, in such a case, both these expressions match with what I have, okay? But in the case where phi equal to constant is null, but other phi are not null, because we also consider that case, then it doesn't really go through. At least in Yasha's case, I know that he did take this as a member of a null foliation, and that's how he was working. Okay, now how to find a boundary term on a null surface? Okay, you might think of taking a direct limit. It's not very clear. Root h goes to 0, k diverges on a null limit, but maybe a combination is as a null limit. At least for the induced metric, so you have this induced metric HAB, it does not have a direct null limit, okay? Because as I said, the counterpart of this that you generally take is this object, which cannot be obtained from this as a limit. Maybe instead of HAB, you use QAB. Maybe there is something, some formula like this that you can use, et cetera, et cetera. So you need a prescription on how to go about doing this. Either a good limiting procedure, which will convert this root HK into a counter term on null surfaces, or some other procedure, okay? Now the procedure that we used is something that is from one of Paddy's recent papers. So he asked the question, suppose I did not know the ADM decomposition, okay? Then how do we rediscover the GHY term? How do we get the boundary term? One way would be as follows. You look at the Einstein-Hilbert action, you vary it, you look at its boundary variation. So it has some structure. Now our purpose is to find some B such that delta B, when added to this, it cancels off the normal derivatives. So first observation is that this boundary term, it can be written in this particular form, where this is delta n a perpendicular, which is over here. This term over here, it has both surface and normal derivatives. The normal derivatives, we do not want it here because you want it over here so that you can cancel it by adding a delta something, adding a total term. So first thing you need to do is to separate out the normal derivatives from here. In order to do that, you have the projector HAB, so you can do it. You can convert it to a derivative, covariant derivative on the boundary plus some extra terms. So then you get it into this form. Now this term has only surface derivatives, no normal derivatives. So all the normal derivatives are now here. Now you know that this is what is known as extrinsic curvature. Okay, and the term here became just KAB delta GAB. You can show that this delta GAB reduces to just HAB, the metric on the surface. And you take the root h in, and this is the complete expression. Okay, so all the surface derivatives are here. This has only the surface metric. All the normal derivatives are over here. Okay, so now if you add a 2 root hk to the Einstein-Hilbert action, you see that you can cancel off these normal derivatives. Okay, so that is, so the use of this method is, it's a sort of constructive method. You have the form of the boundary variation, you analyze it and try to find out what the boundary term is. Okay, this is Paddy's paper from 2014. So once we had it, then we wanted to go and try to see what happens when you do the same for null. Okay, because at least we know how to, what we only have to do is separate out these surface derivatives and see what happens. So analyzing the boundary variation. So now what I'm going to try to do is the following, that I'm going to start with a formalism where I don't want to make a distinction between null and non-null, okay? Because even when I'm considering boundaries, there might be cases where you might have boundaries which are composed of both null and non-null parts. So that way, if I have a different prescription for null and different prescription for non-null, then you might have to sort of divide it and use it separately. So as far as I possible, I want to go ahead and try to see whether I can have a common prescription. This is also, there is another reason personally for me, because when you have a null surface, people usually talk in terms of this null dynamics, where you have a null vector going off the surface. So you have two null vectors, and then you have dynamics along the second null vector. But I would also like to consider cases where you have observers, you have actual observers, time-like observers, who are going through the null surface and then evolve along those observers, okay? So so basically the idea is this. You have a set of observers who might be going through maybe space-like surfaces, time-like surfaces, not time-like surfaces, space-like surfaces, null surfaces, etc. And then in terms of those observers, I want to evolve the stuff. So in that sense, I want a unified prescription for both null surfaces and space-like surfaces. So in order to do that, I'm going to try to remain as general as possible till I have to make a choice, okay? So this is how I start off. First, you consider a four-dimensional manifold, okay? In this four-dimensional manifold, you take a three-dimensional manifold as a boundary, okay? So we shall be considering the Einstein-Hilbert action on one side of the boundary. So you have Einstein-Hilbert action and up to the boundary. Now, we need to specify the position of this boundary somehow, okay? And how do you specify that? The simplest method that one could think of is to introduce a scalar field phi, such that phi equal to phi zero for u will give you the boundary, okay? Now, when we consider variation of the metric, we'll consider the scalar field fix. So if I define this sc equal to covariant derivative of phi, then this variation of this is going to be zero in my framework.
Sorry.
Yeah.
We're supposing the three manifold is closed,
mm-hmm.
and this it's given by this regular value of the scalar field, so it has non-zero gradients everywhere.
Come again. So suppose you have a.
So I'm asking if what are the conditions in phi? It has non-zero gradients everywhere.
If it has non-zero gradients,
it's on phi zero.
Yes, at least in the case that I'm considering, at least for what we have considered, it has non-zero gradients everywhere.
Not everywhere, but on the boundary.
On the boundary. See, because this phi is something that I can choose. So I'm going to choose a phi to have my boundary. So I need to know where my boundary is as some phi equal to constant surface. And as I go off the surface, the phi is going to change. Okay, I want that. So at least in the case that I'm considering, I'll have phi which has a non-zero covariant derivative. So this has to be non-zero. That's what you were asking, right? Whether this is non-zero. In my framework, yes, it is non-zero. Okay, so I borrowed this diagram from Poisson's relatives toolkit. So he has this V, he has this boundary here, and he has used this x0. I'll be using phi, and I have a boundary here which will be phi equal to phi0 for me. Okay, now in order to analyze the boundary variation, the easiest thing is to think of in terms of coordinates phi x1, x2, x3 for some x1, x2, x3. So you have this phi, and I introduce some x1, x2, x3 without specifying what this x1, x2, x3. So in these coordinates, I can do, I have this boundary term in Einstein-Hilbert action, which I can integrate and get an integral over boundary of this. So over here now, this SC is del C phi. Comes over here. This, by algebraic manipulations, I can convert it into this form. So there is a, so delta UC is defined as follows. Okay, this is pure algebra. You take here, you get here. Okay, pure algebra, you can get, go from one to the other. Now again, so this can be converted to total derivative. So over here, this term doesn't have any derivatives of the metric. This term has derivatives of the metric, but we don't care because we can cancel it off by adding a boundary term. What we are worried about is this term. So this term has both tangential derivatives and normal derivatives. Now, here I'll use the term off the surface derivative because for a null surface, normal actually lies on the surface, right? So what I mean is there are derivatives on the surface, which I'll call tangential. And when I say off the surface, it means going off the surface along the direction of not on the surface, okay? So this term has both off the surface derivatives as well as tangential derivatives. We need a prescription to separate out these derivatives.
It's not immediately obvious to me that this is the right physical way to define the surface.
Okay, so
I can imagine various scenarios where if I want to do this for a horizon or something where some definitions along this might be the wrong thing to do. Do you have some story along these lines or no?
So what
you're doing for now, this is all you will have to do.
So you're saying this thing about taking a scalar field phi, which defines the boundary, is that what you're talking about?
I'm saying it's not immediately obvious to me that's always the right physical thing to do.
Okay.
I'm asking whether you had some story along these lines, or this is just what you're doing for the moment, and this is the best you can ever do.
No, so generally, I mean, if you can give me an example where this doesn't work, then probably,
probably in a, say, a cosmological horizon. Probably not the right thing to do.
What do you mean? Any surface can be given.
It's going to depend on how we're going to. So I might want to consider, a cosmology with a varying area, or if this is an infinite space, I have to be taking a limit as it goes to infinity. So I don't have a unified prescription for them either. But I was just asking.
Okay. At least for infinite spaces, I would have to consider for a boundary at infinity, I'll always consider it as a finite region and then take the boundary to infinity. I have to use a limiting procedure. At least in the cases that we have considered, we have always found this to work, as in taking a scalar field phi to specify the position of the boundary and then going ahead. There might be cases where this doesn't work, but at least not in our experience, at least things that we have considered. Okay, but we can talk about it later. So for that, we need to construct a projector. How do we construct a projector? So you have any vector A in the coordinate system that I have. It's of this form. This A phi is this. Now, what I need is an auxiliary vector. So once I have SA, if I have any vector TA, says that TA SA is not equal to 0, which basically means that TA doesn't lie on the surface. It is off the surface. Because TA is equal to 0 is basically the condition that it is on the surface. Using any such vector, I can construct such a projector. This projector is a projector that kills the Fi component. Of course, if it's a non-null surface, I can choose TA to be proportional to SA. So this is just HAV, okay? But this prescription even works for a null surface. You just have to choose a TA such that TA SA not equal to zero. This is a projector that kills the Fi component. What I mean is, if I act on this, this is going to get killed. Okay, I'm going to normalize this, use this normalized vector in here. More explicitly, this is a projector. And if you act it on AB, it is going to kill this component. It might change this component. It doesn't keep it constant, but it's definitely going to kill this component. For a given coordinate system, you might be able to choose this T alpha going to zero. Okay, you might be able to find a projector where only this component is killed and nothing happens to this component. But in general, you cannot do this because this is a coordinate dependent statement saying that you have a auxiliary vector TA and one of its components goes to zero. This is a coordinate dependent statement. It depends on the choice of the coordinates x1, x2, x3. So in general, you cannot do it. But it definitely kills this component. And it is invariant under change. So this projector is invariant under the change of phi to some phi prime, etc. That you can check. It's invariant under scaling of TA. So it only depends on the direction that we choose for TA. So once you have a surface, what you basically need to do is to choose a direction of the surface. It can be any direction. This projector only depends on that direction. It doesn't depend on all the scaling. So another perspective is that you have these basis vectors on the surface. So you have three basis vectors on the surface. You need another basis vector, which is off the surface, so that it can be linearly independent and it can form a basis. So I have this TA and this EA alpha on the surface to form a basis. Note that this pi phi b equal to 0. This phi component is 0 that we'll use in some time. Also, I need an invariant volume element on the surface because I'm doing this boundary integral. On the surface, generally you have, on a non-null surface, you have root h d3x. That is your invariant volume element. But over here, I want to consider both null and non-null. So how do you give a invariant volume element for a null surface on the boundary? Okay. Now, for a non-null surface, as I said, you have root minus g is n root h. Root minus g is c. You can convert into root h hc. Root h, and this is the normalized normal. That is what people generally integrate over. So can we have a similar prescription without restricting to non-null? We have the two vectors TA and SA. So I've just raised this SA over here, assuming that we have an invertible 4 metric. You do that. And now, for a non-null surface, we have the option of choosing TA proportional to SA. Okay. So this auxiliary vector that I've chosen is proportional to SA. And in that case, one can show that this root minus g SA goes to root h NA. That is the usual prescription. But for a null surface, we cannot make this choice. You cannot choose TA to be proportional to SA. Even for a non-null surface, we need not necessarily make this choice. You might want to take TA to be in some other direction other than the direction along SA. Then consider the case where TA is not proportional to SA. They are linearly independent. So in this case, you can choose TA. So there is TA and SA, and right now you only have specified phi equal to constant, which is your boundary. And x1, x2, x3 are not specified. So let's choose a basis. Let's choose a basis in which TA is a basis along the phi direction. Okay. So in fact, since we have SA and SA equal to this 1000, you T bar actually has to be of this form. It is T bar that has to be chosen so that SA dot T bar equal to minus 1. So you have T bar and SA. You take these two as basis vectors. And then you choose two other vectors, EAA, A equal to 1, 2, which are orthogonal to TA and SA. Okay. So now you have four vectors, a basis, and that space. Okay. Nothing about null or non-null. This generally works, either null or null. So these lie on the boundary surface, these vectors. In this coordinate system, the metric takes this form. Okay. So this is the form of the metric. I've chosen this vector, these two vectors to be orthogonal to this vector. That's why this is 0. This is the metric. So in that case, you'll see that root minus g actually goes to this form. And root minus g sc goes to this form. I can write this as root q mc. And if it is a null vector, this is 0. Okay, this is 0 because s square equal to 0 for a null surface. T square need not be 0. Even then, this is 0. And this just reduces to root qsc. Okay? So this, I mean, I've not done it in a very rigorous way. But if you want to do it in a more rigorous way, there is the way in which Eric Poisson derives the surface element in his book for both null and non-null. So over there for null, he uses both TA and SA as n mu. But you can go through the same thing with TA and SA separate. And you'll essentially end up with this answer. Okay? So you can do this rigorously also. At least for null surface, this is root QSC. Okay, this is the element on the surface that you can integrate over. So you go back, this is your boundary term. Okay, Now, we had this project of IAB. Using it, I separate out the tangential and normal derivatives from here, and you get it in this form. So now, this particular term has only surface derivatives. This has only no derivatives. Delta TA, if I define it to be a vector, and so it can either be a constant vector or it can be a vector dependent on metric, but generally I wouldn't take it to be a vector dependent on derivatives of the metric. So this also doesn't have derivatives. All the normal derivatives are sitting over here, and this I can cancel off by adding a boundary term of this form. Okay, so I have a boundary term which is of this form. Only thing I have to do is I have to introduce an extra k into the mix. I have to introduce a vector which is off the surface, and then I can give you this prescription for a boundary term. The good thing about this is if I choose this t bar a, this vector off the surface, as proportional to SA, this reduces directly to the Jeevachevet term. Okay, it reduces to the Gibbons-Hawking term. In fact, this choice actually reduces pi ab to hab. Okay, now, for a null surface, one possible choice of t bar a is to choose it to be null. You can choose this t bar a to be an auxiliary null vector. And just to show that it's null, I'll write SA as LA. In that case, the boundary term becomes the integral of this object. So there is a 2 root q, there is a theta, and a theta plus kappa. Here, theta is the expansion of the null generators, and kappa is the non-affinity parameter which is given by this equation. Okay? That is kappa. So the full boundary variation has this form. So for a null surface, if you take the boundary variation, expand it out, this is the full form. So you can see this is a total surface term. This is what you can cancel off by adding this. Then there is a delta QAB and delta LA term. Okay. Now, one just one note about this particular term over here. So this is a total derivative on the surface. So if you have a closed surface, of course, this does not contribute. But if you have, even if you have a closed surface, if the surface is not smooth, okay, like there are kinks and all, where the derivatives from both sides don't match, then this term can actually contribute. Then you have to add certain terms, certain corner terms at those corners to take care of that. But at least in this, right now I'm not considering that, I'm just considering smooth boundaries. So the prescription is this: you add root q theta plus kappa to cancel off this part, then after that you'll have to fix QAB and LA at the boundary.
Can you make a closed null surface without any corners?
Actually, you cannot. You'll have to, at least the things that I know of, there are corners. Yes. There are corners. In that case, this will contribute, yes. Unless there is, okay, I don't know if there are systems where you can do some sort of gravitational lensing to bend the null rays and make it smooth. Probably. But anyway, that's in the sense that I can always take care of this term, even if there are corners. I just have to make sure that I just have to see what is the discontinuity over there and what this will pick up. Then I can add a corner term to kill that off. So that I can do. That's not a problem. That's just something that we can do. It's not a problem. Right now, I'm only considering this part. Okay.
You're asking something.
So this term looks like it's both coordinate dependent and dependent on the scaling of my generators. Do you have a story about this?
No, so it's not coordinate dependent in that sense, because what happens is I had a K and LA. It's dependent on the choice of my K. So I choose this K to be a null vector, right? Now I choose K.
But you're somehow fixing. It sounds like you're somehow fixing the norm of that. Just in fact, I would say that's something you can't do.
Fixing the norm of?
The K, I mean, if I rescale, at least I would say, you know, if I were writing this down, I would say, I know that my formulas better be independent of any rescaling of that. And this looks like it's definitely dependent on it.
It's actually not, because, see, I have this condition between LA and K, which is LA K equal to minus 1, which I've imposed.
Yeah, but this is just one of those. So I agree that a pair, then that would take care of that problem.
Huh, so are you talking about this formula?
I'm talking about your CN.
For my CN, if I go into this, okay, let me go back to this expression. See, let me go back to this expression. Over here, Ka and La appear together. That you agree, right? In pi AB. So if you go back here, there's this pi AB which is sitting over here.
The freedom is rescaling this.
Ha, so K and LA, if I rescale LA, K has to be rescaled in the other way so that KLA minus 1 is satisfied. So that way, this expression, even if you scale K, you have to rescale LA the other way. So that problem is not there.
For that position.
Ha, yes. And this is exactly what gives me this expression. So I have just put...
We're not communicating here. Maybe you can go on, I did ask you after.
Okay. This might be a problem with the...
Not only the ambiguity in rescaling L and K, you can also shift K by not a vector that is orthogonal to L.
Yeah, there's an ambiguity in which L you're going to choose.
Yeah.
There is an ambiguity in which K you're going to choose. Okay,
yeah,
in the sense...
I agree.
That is true. It's K dependent in the sense that this prescription, it is K dependent. You choose what K it is, and then you get this. But there is, at least my belief is that if you actually look at the change in K, you'll see that it doesn't matter. That particular shift doesn't matter because this theta, this is also the lead derivative along L of square root of Q. So there is this expression for, so theta, I have an expression which is something like this. Right?
Can you write that?
Okay.
It's the expansion of Q, little Q.
It's just a derivative.
So.
I couldn't read what he was writing.
X is on. Yeah.
Okay. You have an expression for theta, which is like this. Now over here, see, this doesn't depend on K. This depends on L. The definition of Q, this has L because QAB equal to GAB plus LAKB plus LBKA. It does have K sitting over here, but K and L come together. So if you scale K, you have to scale L the other way. So the scaling of K doesn't matter here. Of course, if you actually,
it will umbrella. If you redo this combination, this rule on K and L,
then rescaling doesn't matter.
Your lead derivative will not.
Yes. So rescaling doesn't matter. Then you can,
I just said the opposite. Yes. Is that right?
Yeah. So. Okay. Oh, so you're saying that if you rescale, then
you rescale, your Q will be left independent, but the lead derivative will not. You're changing how much you're changing.
So the Q will change, but the lead derivative will not. Yes.
But now I'm confused. Isn't big capital theta itself a boundary term? Because you don't integrate over. So you integrate over your unit surface.
True. It is the transverse one. K is along the surface.
It's the other way around.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you're asking whether this only had surface terms, no, theta. The theta only has surface derivatives along the surface. That's what you are asking, right? Tangential derivatives.
Okay.
It doesn't have normal derivatives, right? That is true. In this formalism, you can actually check it doesn't have any derivatives off the surface, okay? So if you want to do it, this was something that I was going to come to in the next slide. This theta actually only have tangential derivatives. It doesn't have normal derivatives. So all the normal derivatives over here actually sitting at kappa. Okay, so as far as this 2 root k theta plus kappa is concerned, see scaling definitely doesn't matter because at least this we have checked. Suppose you try to scale LA, try to scale KA, you go through the whole formalism and try to see where you end up here. Okay, it doesn't change. In fact, the whole, there is also a d lambda d2x sitting over here. So the whole CN, if I write the whole CL, okay, maybe. So basically, this is what I'm saying. See, this is not the whole boundary term. There's a d lambda d2x sitting over here, where d lambda is the parameter along LA. Okay. Okay, the whole thing is of the form okay. Now you take this formula, you try various scalings, etc. This we have tried. And we always see that this is actually invariant. Something might change here, but this d lambda will also scale, and together you can actually see that it's invariant under scale.
You're somehow fixing if that's true, that you can only get that true by fixing some additional condition. If that
additional
were a general
condition.
Affine parameter, that would not be true.
Oh, it's not an affine parameter. It's a parameter, it's not an affine parameter. Because if it was an affine parameter, this kappa would anyway go to zero. Because that's basically your acceleration here, right? So lambda is a parameter. So lambda is a parameter such that, so you'll have LA, you'll have to take it as dou xa by dou lambda.
Yeah.
So what was the parameter there? It need not be an affine parameter. You choose it, the parameter. So if you scale LA, this lambda also changes.
Okay, right? And if you do this, this makes this into a non-local thing. Because now you have this additional restriction you're putting on what lambda is. This is not impossible, but it's outside the realm of the normal things we consider.
So why do you call it non-local?
Because you're saying lambda is defined by this additional condition. So that's some additional equation, which makes lambda into some non-local. To get lambda, I have to solve this additional equation I've given.
So. Yeah, so on the boundary, this has to be integrated over this d lambda d2x, which is dou xa by dou lambda. You're saying that in order to solve this, I have to solve these two equations, which is.
Yep.
These two.
If I understand what you're saying, then, yes.
Yes.
So your lambda implicitly has some functions in the metric variable.
In the whole.
So can we leave?
Yeah.
So
keep going.
Come back to this.
Release everyone who doesn't care about the details.
Okay, so at least with this prescription, so I don't know about this non-local thing that we can discuss, but at least with this prescription, we have tried scaling, et cetera, and then it doesn't change. Okay, and I'll just come back to that. So this is the full boundary term. You have to fix both QAB and LA at the boundary. The assumption that we have made is that phi equal to phi zero is a null surface. Other phi equal to constant surfaces are not null. You have L square equal to zero, K square equal to zero, L dot K equal to minus one. These things, so this particular thing came from our general formalism, but this expression was derived using a formalism which was restricted to null. It was not from our general formalism that I've introduced with the KA, but with a formalism where I use the usual QAB. So for that, I needed to have these conditions imposed. L square equal to zero, K square equal to zero, and L dot K equal to minus one. So these were imposed. This is not ideal because, for example, delta L square equal to zero directly translates to delta G phi phi equal to zero. So it's like I'm saying that the variations are those variations only which preserve the null nature of the boundary surface, okay? It's like I'm imposing that condition. So this is not ideal, but when I only had a way of dealing with the null surfaces, this is the best I could do. Unless I have a way in which I can treat both null surfaces and non-null surfaces together, I cannot consider such variations, okay? Which is something that we are trying to do, but at least this calculation is with this condition. One would like to keep the variations arbitrary. Okay, this is one motivation for trying to construct a unified framework. So we have already shown that there is a prescription for the boundary term in the unified framework, but there is no prescription yet for how to decompose it in this form. Okay, and what is to be fixed on the null surface? You see that you have QAB and LA to be fixed on the null surface. QAB seems natural. It is a two metric on the boundary. Where is LA coming from? Delta LA, if you look at it, it is delta GAFI. So if you make a direct correspondence to ADM variables, this seems to correspond to N and N alpha. So why is that happening? Why is N and N alpha coming in? But you have to consider this, that if you're considering a null surface, then LA is also one of the basis vectors on the null surface. So LA, in this case, is actually lying on the null surface. So when you're varying LA, you're varying a vector which is lying on the null surface. This can be seen more concretely as follows. Originally, you had a metric which is of this form on the null surface. Now, if you vary it, you can actually show that the variations are of this form, okay? Over here, this has to vanish if the surface has to remain null, but then there are these extra terms also. So out of the components of delta LA, except the component delta LA K, all the other three components appear over here, okay? So if you come from the H alpha beta has to be fixed on the boundary background, you would have thought that you have to fix all these components, and you would expect the same things to appear there on the null surface boundary. So it happens, it does, these things do appear. Only thing is that this extra component delta LA K that is not appearing here, even that is present. I mean, even that was present in that particular boundary. So this we do not understand. Well, the reason this does not change the surface metric is that delta LA K is what actually decides the scale of LA. So if you scale LA, it doesn't change this form of the metric, because null vector can be scaled. So that is why this doesn't appear here. Okay, on non-uniqueness, so there is this thing that even if you have the GHY term, you can always add to it some term which depends only on the metric on the surface and surface derivatives of the metric. And even then, there will be no normal derivatives introduced, right? So you can always add such terms to the GHY term. So the GHY term that way is not unique, okay, if you just want to remove the normal derivatives of the metric. So any term which only has a surface derivative, which is of this form, can always be converted into a total derivative and other terms. So if you have a total derivative term, this is a total variation term with surface derivatives here. It can be converted into a surface derivative as well. So you can always go between total variation term and surface derivative, go back and forth. So there is no unique prescription for a boundary term if your only condition is cancel off the normal derivatives. So, yes. Now, coming to null surfaces, so this problem appears again here because, as you were pointing out, this theta which appears here, it only has surface derivatives. It doesn't have normal derivatives. All the normal derivatives are over here in kappa, okay? So if we choose the level surface of phi to be null, this kappa actually goes to zero in our case, okay? So if you have phi equal to constant all as null, in that case, this kappa doesn't appear. You only have a theta, which only has surface derivatives. And in that case, it seems that you even don't have a boundary term. So if you have a null surface, which is embedded in a foliation of null surface, at least in our formalism, you might even get through without adding a boundary term. Another thing is, we also try to take the direct null limit of the GHY term, using certain limiting formalisms. And in that case, we did end up with this term, plus there was this extra term on the boundary, okay? So that way, the question of a boundary term for null surface is not completely closed. There is something that we can propose. You can say that, okay, this is something that you can use to eliminate the normal derivatives. But the question of whether it corresponds directly to the GHY term is also not clear. And what are the degrees of freedom to be fixed on the boundary is also not clear. But we do have this decomposition, the boundary variation of Einstein-Hilbert action on a null boundary, which is basically this. So there are questions of uniqueness. What is the best way to characterize these degrees of freedom on the null boundary? And we are also trying to develop a unified treatment of null and non-null boundaries. So whatever treatment that I was just trying to develop up to some extent from which we got a boundary term, we want to develop it further and take it to the point where we can also separate out these degrees of freedom without splitting into null and non-null, okay? So that is it. And okay, this is some quote from Paddy's recent book, which I like. Okay, I give you that.
We already had a lot of discussion and we're a bit over time, so we won't have time for many questions, but we can take a few. Yeah.
So,
if you have something like only null surfaces, a closed region is only null surfaces, then keeping somehow like native fix, I wouldn't expect that this is gives you very fine boundary problem at all.
If you have null surface and if you keep the
if you have basically something like a diamond region, the higher dimensional generalization of a diamond region.
Yes.
Then you usually cannot fix kind of boundary data on this diamond region and get the solution. It's usually over decomposed.
If you fix, so if you have a diamond region and if you fix
boundary data on this diamond region,
yes,
you usually completely overdetermine.
You usually overdetermine the system. You're saying
the system. So now you basically say you have a variation principle is null boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So if I consider basically the same thing.
So in that case, so what do you fix on the boundary? Which what do you fix on the boundary in that case?
I mean, that's something very general. If you take a scalar field or whatever.
It's like specifying initial conditions on both an initial surface and the final surface.
Yeah.
So,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that a fair mistake?
Yeah. If you do it in 2D on this, with a scalar field.
Yeah, because it's got both pieces. And you can do one or the other, you can't do both.
For a scalar field in general, but
yeah.
Even for
it's basically using characteristic data and so on, so kind of a numerical gravity. That
yeah, no, I agree. A null surface is a good initial data surface.
And what keeping fixed and what are initial data? So that's basically the question: what is actually the boundary problem, variation problem you are considering at the end? If you only have.
Okay, so. For this question, I would go back to the formalism that is already existing in the literature. For example, if I look at, say, double null dynamics cases, so on a null surface, of course, Basu would be a better expert on this. As far as I understand, if you have a null surface, you define the two metric on the null surface. Actually, you define the conformal two metric, but based on the conditions that you specify on the junction, you get the full two metric on the boundary. And then you also have to define the derivatives on the boundary, and then you can evolve it uniquely, right?
That,
so,
yeah, but how does it fit into this framework? I mean,
so,
there you conclude that you have to fix some other things. Is it the same thing?
So, if I have an initial problem, if somebody gives me an initial problem, I can always convert it to a boundary problem by considering the case where you have the boundary surfaces which are coming very close together. So, if somebody tells me that I have to, at least this is the way I think about it. If I say that somebody tells me that I have to fix some phi and derivative phi at this boundary, I can always think of another boundary coming very close to each other. So, fixing both phi and phi dot at this boundary is same as fixing both phi at this boundary as well as phi at this boundary.
Yeah,
so, in that
two problems, I mean, one is the diamond region is different, and my question is how does it fit the boundary data you have to keep fixed in your analysis here?
How does it fit?
I mean, basically, so, variational principle with boundary terms, I mean, it does two things. It gives you boundary term, but it also does tell you
so,
what kind of things to keep fixed.
So in for the case of a diamond thing, so for a diamond thing, I don't know exactly how it works because you have these two surfaces, right? But suppose I choose only one, two of them, like this one and this one, choose the other ones to go to, say, I don't know. You just take these two together, two null surfaces. So at least the problem that I'm considering is...
Okay, I'm not really asking this question because...
So at least for the bound...
If you specify the scalar field on these two slices, there's no scalar field that will determine everything.
Yeah, but because what you're telling me is that for a diamond, you have to choose different boundaries, different things keeping fixed.
Okay, so...
Depending on what you want to consider.
So,
but that doesn't seem to fit into this action principle.
So for diamond, I don't know how it works. At least the thing that I think about, the thing that I was considering is more like you have this null surface, which is like this. You consider another null surface, which is over here, and then consider the boundary evolution from here to here and ask what is to be fixed here, what is to be fixed here. So whatever, there might be a null surface here or whatever null surface here, etc. That might actually make, if you actually consider a finite diamond region, it might make a difference. But at least at this point of time, we are not worried about that. We are just only worried about the initial surface to final surface. The other, these boundaries here, which are the other null surfaces, that we are not worried about, at least at this point of time. Okay, so.
Yeah, Yeah, it's also a question whether this gives you actually a well-defined boundary, so this, I mean, whether the solution is well-defined and unique and exists.
So at least Vasu has to support me here. At least as far as I understand, what I said seems to be true, that if you have a null surface, and if you specify the 2 metric on the null surface, then there's a unique way in which you can evolve it from that null surface to the next null surface, right? If you take this to be the next null surface. Now the other null surface, which is over here, which is the boundary, so that, what it does, it's not very clear to me. At least from this surface to that surface, I can evolve that.
Yeah, I mean, that's solution of the characteristic initial value problem specified. But that's also what you're saying.
Yeah, I think sounds like everyone agrees on
that.
The null surfaces are good initial data surfaces, yes.
Right.
I think we all agree.
Yes.
Right. In that sense, I think that you would have to tilt your head, basically. In the sense of,
tilt your head meaning you believe them or you don't?
No. Tilt your head in the sense of how you look at the relation between what you specify in an initial value problem and what happens for a boundary value problem in terms of the action principle. This is what you were asking. So how you would think about it for a space-time surface, I'm saying you tilt your head and you think of it as going on this direction for a null surface, basically. And so.
See, at least for the boundary term, I can even.
Must move it.
Hold on.
Okay.
The ambiguities are the ambiguity. I agree, but all I'm saying is that it's not ambiguous as to what you're fixing. I mean, we're not overdetermining the system by fixing data on that surface.
I think the point is that if you try to fix them on both,
exactly.
You can't do that.
You don't do that. You don't fix it on both. That's all I'm saying. So
that seems to be part of the prescription.
I see. Okay.
So we're suggesting that this is too strong a condition.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to be able to physically impose this.
Right.
Okay. See, the well-postedness of actually the evolution itself. So that, as I said, at least in this picture, when I have two boundaries, I can think about it. The other boundary, it might create a problem. This I'm not sure about. The only thing is, at least up to this point, our original motivation to eliminate those normal derivatives and get it only on the surface. Whether the thing actually works, whether it's well-posed in that sense for various null boundaries, that is something that has to be looked at, yes.
So are you fixing something beyond just the corner terms on the other null surface is the question?
On the other null surfaces.
Right. So,
yeah.
So I mean,
if
you might get away with fixing just corner.
No, it's fixing.
Okay. Well, it depends on, are you fixing just the determinant of Q, or are you fixing the conformal?
On the corner, you mean?
On the corner, is it just on the corner that you're fixing Q, or is it?
So if you ask me, I think what is going to happen is, suppose you choose a case where you only have null foliation. That is what you would be familiar with.
Yes.
Then this kappa goes to zero, okay? So you only have this theta term. This theta term is basically lead derivative of root q. So if you actually integrate at the corner, you would basically get root q to be fixed here.
Right.
That's my feeling.
Yes.
Okay, it's probably root q that is going to come
in
on the
corner,
bottom, at the corner. You'll have a q term over there. Okay, but yeah. So I don't have a direct answer for what happens for a diamond as such. Yes.
So we're way over time. I'm going to cut the questions here. You can slater.
Thank you.